We're now going to go live with today's show's new Storm Chaser Van Cam and reporter Ron McDonald. Ron?
I'm proud to be joining the Today Show as part of the Storm Chaser Van Cam Mobile Studio. This vehicle was designed to get as close as possible to a tornado, particularly a Sharknado.
This is Gilbert Gottfried, and I'm here with my co-host, Frank Santopadre. And this is Gilbert and Frank's Amazing Colossal Obsessions. We're once again recording at Nutmeg with our engineer, Frank Bertarossa, who ruined, like, about four of our shows, didn't he?
No, you started that rumor, which is untrue.
Now, we have someone on who I've worked with before. And
he's willing to admit it and talk about it.
Yes.
We worked together on the soon-to-be-released Sharknado 5. Ladies and gentlemen, meet Anthony C. Ferrante.
Hey, guys. How you doing?
Anthony.
Yeah, you got it.
Now, so you are related to me and Frank were talking about Ferrani and Teicher.
I've been told that there is a relation there, which makes sort of sense. So I can play piano a little bit, so I guess there you go. I've never really investigated how I'm related, but that would blow my mind. Relation,
because this show is all about show business history, and in many cases, you know, the connections, the strange connections. If the director of the Sharknado franchise was related to Ferrante, that would cause me sleepless
nights.
They
used to be on the air like every minute. Back then.
Yeah, they did the lounge stuff. It was the lounge kind of
music
a little bit, too,
right?
Yeah, yeah. So to go from the lounge music, and then we actually, Robbie Rist and I wrote the theme song for Sharknado, the Ballad of Sharknado. So, you know, there's some lineage there, you know, so it's that pop culture kitsch stuff. So it kind of fits
Is Robbie a friend, Cousin Oliver?
Yeah, Cousin Oliver and I have a band called Quint, so we do a lot of the songs in the Sharknado movies.
We love Robbie. We see him on Facebook all the time.
What I love about Sharknado is the... I get to travel
to a green screen.
Yes. I did Sharknado 4, and that was supposed to take place in Texas. I was riding a van, a weather van, through Texas, and I said, "Oh, are we going to Texas?" And they said, "No, we're going to be doing it in Central Park." Because, you know, if you've ever been in Central Park, you go, wow, how did I wind up in Texas? And now in Sharknado 5, my character is now in Africa. And
Rio, and even said, though we don't see the Rio thing.
How will we do this? And they said, well, we're planning on shooting in Central Park again. Because in Africa, quite often... you'll see an old lady on a park bench feeding pigeons.
Hey, you know, we ended up doing it on green screen because we didn't have time to get to Central Park this time. But the area in Central Park, the big rock formation, was like, you know, we took some photos. Like, this could actually work as Africa. But that's compared to what we did in the fourth one, where aside from Las Vegas, we shot most of the United States in a parking lot in Los Angeles. But the fifth one, we went abroad. We went to 5 different countries. So you didn't get to come with us, but we went to Bulgaria, England, Italy, Japan, and Australia. So we kind of basically upgraded from parking
lot. See, they're traveling, Gilbert. You're not traveling.
But don't feel bad for me. I got to see Central Park.
Well, give our listeners some context, too. What's your character?
Oh, okay.
Is it the same character in 4 and 5?
Yes, okay. Yes. I'm Ron McDonald, investigative reporter, action reporter. And I think to show the care that's put into Sharknado movies, In the first one, they filmed me in a cow-nado. It was a bunch of cows.
Oh, cows, a cow-nado.
And I got, they all fell on me and I died. And I heard if you see one version of it, if you rent it, I die in the cow-nado. If you see it on TV, I don't.
Yeah, actually what happened that was is we ran out of visual effects shots because it takes, you know, we have like 2 months to do like 1,000 shots usually. And we had a sort of a coda where a shark or a cow slammed into you in front of the van. It didn't make it into the sci-fi cut. But when we get to do the DVD version, which I call the slightly better version, we're able to kind of put extra things in because we never really fit, you know, we're finishing things up to the wire. So it gives us a chance to kind of finesse for DVD. And they did an extra shot because I love the idea of you getting smashed by a cow, but you didn't die. You just broke an arm.
No, yes.
I mean, it still works.
I'm in the next Sharknado in a little arm cast around my wrist because that's what happens if you're in a cow-nado.
Well, now that you're bringing up the
exactly.
next one, we'll plug it. Sharknado 5 Global Swarming. And Anthony, when does it premiere?
It premieres August 6th, this coming Sunday on Sci-Fi. I believe it's like 8 or 9 o'clock, one of those times.
Okay, so 2 days from now. Because this will be on Thursday.
Great, yeah. It's Sci-Fi Super Bowl. People get together, have parties.
I know,
and
it's a cultural phenomenon.
Tweet live to us.
Now, is there certain things with Sharknado where they take a drag on a reefer or take a shot?
I always tell people this. I think the thing is I can safely say that the creation and the writing and the making of Sharknados are not made under the influence of under any kind of drugs or alcohol, which should scare people even
yes.
more.
But you have called it one of the great stoner movies of all time.
Well, yeah. When we were watching the first cut of the finished cut of the first movie before it aired, I watched it and said, you know, this is maybe in 5 years it's going to be a cult movie, and we probably made the greatest stoner movie ever, you know, unintentionally. And of course, I think both of those came true pretty quickly. It wasn't 5 years; it was kind of instantaneous.
Uh-huh.
And stoners across the world are just embracing it. We actually do have a potnado in this movie.
So. and I love when people ask me; they say, "Well, do you get killed in the movie?" And I said, it really doesn't make a difference in the movies. That's using logic that if someone's killed, that it's over with them. It's like in the Sharknado movies, you watch someone get killed, and two scenes later, they're walking around.
Or they're chainsawing their way out of a shark.
Yes.
But we do kill people in this movie for good in the new movie. We actually get pretty dark. It becomes Empire Strikes Back in this movie.
Oh, I like that. Tell us, give our listeners some history, Anthony. Tell us how you first got involved in the franchise. Is it true that you and your partner were spitballing titles?
Yeah, Jacob Hare and I occasionally write with him. He's a really amazing guy, a really amazing animator, and I was doing a lot of horror movies for Sci-Fi, and so they always would want to hear, come up with the ghost title, come up with the Leprechaun and
Leprechaun's Revenge.
Leprechaun's Revenge. There you go, and that's which is the first Sharknado sighting. And so we're throwing Lava Birds, and then Jake goes Sharknado, and we love that title so much, and we kept trying to figure out what to do with it. We pitched it to one of the companies that does pitching to Sci-Fi, which I think didn't pitch it to them as Sharknado, but as like Sharkstorm or something. And so in the Leprechaun script, I wrote a reference to a Sharknado because they were trying to cover up the leprechauns. And it said something like, you know, we don't want to have what happened in that town over. Remember Sharknado? They never lived that down. And Sci-Fi saw that name and they're going, we must make this movie. And that's kind of the evolution. Jake and I always knew what a great title it was. And when we were shooting the first movie, no one wanted to be in a movie called Sharknado, so they called it Dark Skies.
Oh,
and so we always kind of knew it was going to be called Sharknado. And the third day of shooting, we were shooting in the hardware store, and all my cast like cornered me and said, come here. And it was like, it was like reminded me of Frankenstein, you know, with the pitchforks and the fire. And they're going, we heard this movie might be called Sharknado. It's like, well, they might call it that or they might call it something else. No, they didn't. They got to call it Great White Skies. They got to do this. You got to make sure that they don't call this. And apparently Tara and Ian were freaked out. I think Ian says that, you know, he got onto his agent saying, you got to get me out of this thing. But I remember telling them specifically. I told them, if it's called Sharknado, it will be a good thing. Because we knew the title had magic. And, you know, that was one thing I was sort of right about. But they were freaked out about it. But the cool thing is that they didn't let it affect their performance. I mean, Ian Ziering chainsaw his way out of a shark, birthing himself out of the shark. And he did that with gusto. And he there was no, like, I'm going to do this, but I'm going to do it half-ass. He gave 100%. So did Tara. Everybody gave a crap on that movie. To kind of, they embrace the cheese with it, but they all the characters play it straight, which is what the magic of the movie is. It's kind of like Airplane. If everybody's in on the joke and plays it up as camp, it's not as funny as if you're playing it straight. So the silliness comes from the event, which is the Sharknado, everything and the circumstances. Everything else is they're in a movie about lava or they're in a movie about an earthquake.
Well, we've talked about that on this show, how originally the studio wanted them to put comedians in Airplane. And the Zuckers were saying, no, you need Lloyd Bridges. You need Leslie Nielsen. You need straight-faced actors.
And the funny thing is with Leslie Nielsen, in those first couple of, like, Airplane and Naked Gun, he was hysterical because he was playing it straight.
Poker-faced, yeah.
And then later on, I think he started to say, hey, I'm pretty funny. And then he started acting goofy in these movies.
Well, one of the things, too, I want to give a shout-out to John Hurd. John Hurd was the first person we cast in the first Sharknado movie, and he passed away.
Yeah, we were just going to ask you about him.
Destroyed us. But he kind of got it. And I remember him telling me, like, on the last day of shooting, he's like, I don't know what the heck you're doing, but I think there's some sort of method to your madness. And I think, you know, I think this is going to be really cool. And the thing with John is John basically gives a little of the comic relief in Sharknado, but he plays it straight. And having him there gave us a lot of credibility, and that got us to Ian and Tara and everybody after that. But I recently watched the movie, and he's just so good in the film. And, you know, we kind of improvised a little bit, and he did all this amazing stuff. And, you know, when we were at Comic-Con and we heard about it, it was just heartbreaking because he supported it from the beginning. He was the one guy that was on board and such a great actor. And I remember hanging out with Comic-Con the first year that Sharknado broke. We hung out with him, and it was just, you know, it was cool. Great guy, great actor, and, you know, it's sad to see that amazing talent not here anymore.
Yeah, underrated actor, really. And good in comedies. I mean, if you think of, I think of Scorsese's After Hours.
Oh, yeah. And because in Cutter's Way, sure. Shirley Sneed's a winner. But you look at all the movies that he was in Big. He just was in everything. Cat People.
Yeah, that's right.
For as weird
Cat
as that movie was,
Paul
he's
Schrader.
Great in that movie.
Yeah, very underrated.
And what I remember about Cat People is Nastassja Kinski and Annette O'Toole both being naked in it.
Yes, as you pointed out to Michael McKean when he was here about his wife.
Well, I wanted to pay her a compliment. We will return to Gilbert Gottfried's Amazing Colossal Podcast after this.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
On May 10th, Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes is coming to IMAX and theaters everywhere.
What a wonderful day!
This summer, one movie event will reign.
It is our time.
They stole my village.
I know where they're taking your clan.
Bend for your king.
Never.
Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes. Only in theaters May 10th. Tickets on sale now. Rated PG-13. Some material may be inappropriate for children under 13.
And now back to the show. His death scene, too, John Hurd in the first Sharknado. Very funny.
Yeah. One of the things, you know, we were trying to come up with weapons and stuff, and when we were working on the script, the idea of the bar stool being his weapon, the thing is, I always knew that the movie needed to go a little further and be a little odd. So in the script, I buried the idea that because it makes sense he would not leave his bar stool if the whole thing was going to collapse. So I buried the idea that the bar stool was being taken with him. So it was sort of there, but we never drew attention to it because I knew I was going to have him use it as a weapon and carry it around most of the movie. And I knew the producers might go, what are you doing? This makes no sense. But I knew it would work.
Right.
And he had just went – John had just went through an operation at that time. I might have been like a heart operation or something. And that bar stool was heavy. And, you know, he never complained once. And, you know, if he said, I don't want to carry this, we wouldn't have had him carry it. But he wanted to. He was in it. But that thing was it was hard for me to lift up. And this man who had been through an operation, like, I'm doing it. And it's like he is the true action hero of that thing. Because that bar stool was, I think, one of the funniest bits in the film. You know, he's just not going to let it go.
Terrific actor.
And did Ian Ziering have any idea what a second career he would have?
I don't think anybody knew that it was going to blow up like it did. Like I said, we kind of all, like, you know, we knew the title was special and we knew we made something that was kind of unique, you know, for what it was, you know, put together with, you know, chewing gum and duct tape. And, you know, we just made this crazy movie that could have destroyed everybody's careers and didn't. But I think that, you know, I think they kind of did it and they just thought it was just going to be another movie, both her, him and Tara, that was going to come and go. And then that night it blew up and everybody found us. I mean, it's one of those rare instances where there was no marketing. It was all the stuff that we did grassroots. You know, we put out the trailer early. We did a music video. We started a Facebook page that myself and a couple other people just kind of posted stuff on. And then I remember one of my editors from a previous film, Chris Conley, he called me up like 2 days before the movie airs going, you know, I was in 7-Eleven and people are talking about Sharknado. I'm like, yeah, right. Because, you know, I've written and directed a bunch of these movies where, you know, they come out, they have their little audience and then they go away. It's like, why would someone in 7-Eleven be talking about Sharknado? And I was wrong about that. He was accurate. And then that night, it was a Twitter storm. You know, it was just bizarre to see. You know, we were going to do live commentary, and I thought I was going to get, hey, you suck, Ferrante, and all this other stuff. And suddenly people are just having fun, and you couldn't keep up with the tweets, like Mia Farrow and Damon Lindelof and Judah Friedland. It was like,
Patton Oswalt.
Patton Oswalt. Yeah. So, you know, I don't know what it was. I think, you know, everybody keeps Monday morning quarterbacking about what it might have been. I think it was the trailer looked like basically something that looked like a studio movie that, There's no way it could live up to it. So I think they're going, we got to see this because this looks insane and crazy. And then they saw it and it was wall-to-wall action for a low-budget movie.
Sure.
And it was the title and it was free and it was a summer where pretty much all the movies that came out were kind of depressing and dark. And it's also kind of strangely family values wholesome. So kids could watch it even though people's limbs are being ripped off. But Robbie Riss, Robbie also knew that it had potential. And when he saw a rough cut of the movie, he said, it's a movie that doesn't know it can't do that. And
that's great.
I live and stand by that with the whole phenomena is that it continues to prove it's a movie that doesn't know it can't do that, both from the way the phenomena broke and then just how we pull these movies off each time. And we don't have like 2 years and $100 million. You know, we're still kind of, you know, a tiny little movie that somehow – you know, we find a way to go shoot in these different countries. You know, we go there and we're figuring it out as we go along. It's not like we had like a crew, kind of an ongoing crew of about maybe six people that traveled to all the countries and then our cast. And then we would pick up production services places in those countries. And we just went and had fun. It's like a party. It's hard work, but, you know, 6 months and we have a movie finished like this.
I think timing is certainly part of it, as you say, but also it's rewarding to people who are pop culture aficionados like we are. And Patton, we know, is a movie buff. That when you're watching something like this, there's Twilight Zone references. You know, there's the Baywatch opening. There's all kinds of a lot of movie dialogue. There's stuff that's rewarding to for people like us.
I've always been a geek, and you know,
a lot of inside jokes.
You know, a lot of inside jokes. Some of them that go completely over people's heads. Even in my first movie, Boo. I love that movie, The Changeling, by George C.
Scott. Oh, we talk about that movie on this show. Sure.
Yeah. So there is a little the ball that rolls down the stairs appears in my movie, and the guy that played the kid in that movie, Voldy Way, was a friend of the producer's. So we snuck him into the film, and he's being pulled away in this mental thing, and someone says, "Time to take your bath, Carmichael." So that's like so
that's
buried.
Great.
You know, five people will get it. My best obscure reference was in Headless Horseman, my second movie. And it was so it's about a it's a Headless Horseman movie. So in the convenience store, there is a art department poster that's Rollins Thompson gum sold
here. A Warren Zevon reference.
There you go.
Bless your heart.
Because he has Rollin the Headless Thompson Gunner. So that was my little nod to Warren, who I love.
Oh.
So we always put stuff in. And then first movie was kind of Jawsy, you know, so we had the little Jaws references and stuff. But then in the second movie, I really wanted to do that kind of homage to the Nightmare at 20,000 Feet, the Twilight Zone episode. And when we were getting ready to shoot it, my wife and my daughter and I were watching Airplane, and she says, well, you got to get Robert Hayes. So I called the producer saying, we must get Robert Hayes to play the pilot. And he's going, no, because then, you know, you're going to do Airplane references. And then with my fingers crossed, I'm going, I promise we will never do an Airplane reference if we cast him. And they go, okay. And, of course, we did Airplane references. And that kind of was the beginning of where we were able to kind of do things like that in Sharknado, where it kind of the tide shifted and we were kind of making more little references to things. Even the taxi, you know, we had Judd.
Yeah,
Hirschman,
I was going to bring that up
driver.
Too. Yeah.
And then if you look at the cab company, it's the Bickle cab company. So,
oh, a taxi, you know, driver just, reference. Yeah. But that's catnip for guys like Gilbert and me.
Oh yeah,
we love that. We love
Travis
that stuff.
Bickle.
Yeah, we love that stuff. I mean, and I'm saying when you get Damon Lindelof and Patton and Olivia Wilde and people like that are tweeting about it, and I think part of that is people are jazzed by the fun of that. I mean, it's a movie on one level, but it's a parlor game too. There's a lot going on.
And it's stuff, too, that we're not sitting there going, hey, look, telegraphing, look at this. It's like, for me, it's stuff that as a geek, I put in for myself in the handful of other people. I had to fight to get Christine in the fourth movie. It was one of those things where they said, you can have this or you can have Christine. And I'm like, the car from, you know. The
sure.
Movie. I go, okay, well, I'll take Christine any day. And then in the fifth movie, let's see if you get this. So we're shooting in London, and we had the opening is at Stonehenge, and so we have a reference to Silver Shamrock, and so our working title when we were doing it to throw people off of Sharknado was that we were called Silver Shamrock. So do you know the pop culture reference to Silver Shamrock?
Oh, is that the Halloween?
Ooh,
yeah.
Gilbert. Nice work, Gilbert.
Three more days to Halloween, Halloween, yep. Halloween.
You pulled that
three
out.
More days to Halloween, Silver Shamrock.
Yep, there
that
you
was,
go.
And so Halloween 3, and I forget that actor.
Season of the Witch. Was it Tom Atkins?
He was the handsome lead. But who is the villain?
Dan O'Herlihy.
Yes.
From Twin Peaks.
Yep.
Yeah.
So they're in the Stonehenge cave. You'll see a little silver shamrock thing and a melted skeleton mask. So it's a blink if you miss it, but it's one of those little Easter eggs.
You know what my favorite part of Halloween 3 was? Dan O'Herlihy has Stonehenge in his place. He has it there.
Yes.
And his only explanation, the only thing the writers could come up with for him to say on how he was able to move Stonehenge to his room is, we had quite a time getting it over.
Good gag.
Yeah, so it's okay.
But, you know, the weird part is, I don't know if you've been to Stonehenge. We went to Stonehenge and we actually kind of stole the location and shot a few shots there when we weren't supposed to. But Stonehenge is small.
Yes.
So I always thought
I was
Stonehenge
there.
Is this it's huge. And I'm thinking, oh my God. And you get there and it's like, I could take two steps and I'm there and I could probably lift up one of the rocks. So I always thought it was kind of weird in Halloween 3, but now I kind of buy, you could probably have taken a few of those rocks. Hey, we shot Sharknado there and they didn't know we were doing it. So, I mean, sure, Dan O'Herlihy in a helicopter stealing Stonehenge isn't that far-fetched.
I was doing a job in London and I decided I got to go to Stonehenge. And also, I thought it would be this, you get the impression it's enormous. And then, you know, you see it and it's like, some rocks.
I wanted to ask you, have you heard from Carl Gottlieb about all the Jaws stuff?
You know, I ran into Carl Gottlieb, I think it was right after Sharknado 1. Right. There was a screening for Jaws 3D in Hollywood, and I went to go see it. And I don't know if it was in 3D or not. Maybe it was or maybe it was. I can't remember. But he was there, and so I went up and talked to him a little bit. And we actually tried to get him and the director of Jaws 3D, which his name is escaping me right now, Joe Alves.
Yeah, Joe Alves, right.
I think he did the production design on First Jaws. And so we were going, oh, it'd be cool to kind of sneak them into Sharknado 2 or 3. And it never worked
out. Too bad,
because
he's a comedy writer in addition to writing Jaws. I think he would appreciate this.
Yeah, it would have been a blast to kind of get him in there. But the one thing that I think was really cool is we're at Universal Orlando for shooting number 3, Oh Hell No, and they didn't have the ride, which bummed us because they had recently gotten rid of the Jaws attacking thing, but they still had the Jaws dangling in one of the little piers there. And so we wanted to do a gag with that Jaws thing. I guess we had to go and get permission from Amblin, which is basically sure. Spielberg's company, and I probably Spielberg had to sign off on it. I mean, it helps that Sci-Fi is part of NBC, which is part of Universal, but Amblin signed off on it, which to me is like, okay, that's the closest that I'll be able to kind of, you know, touch Spielberg's garment, you know, that they're aware of Sharknado and they're okay if we're kind of paying a little nod
and
to
it. Have you ever used or tried to get Richard Dreyfuss?
Richard Dreyfuss was on the list for, I think, the second or third movie, and it never worked out. I think they reached out to him. Sometimes people want to be in the movies, and sometimes they don't, or sometimes it's scheduling. As you know, a lot of times it's like, hey, Gilbert, we want you in the movie. Are you available tomorrow at 4?
Yes.
Is that how you
approach
them?
And suddenly the night before, we're writing dialogue. And I think that stuff you got was written the night before.
Yeah, and luckily I wasn't doing the Chuckle Barn in Indianapolis.
You've also had some of our podcast guests, Anthony Paul Schaefer, Penn yes. Jillette, and Gary Busey. So there's three of our peeps.
Paul Schaefer was amazing when they told us we were going to do Paul Schaefer. I'm like, oh, we got to get Paul to do one of our songs. He played basically an out of work performer because he wasn't on Letterman anymore, and we had written a New York song for number 2. And to teach Paul Schaefer how to do the song that we wrote was kind of like, I mean, I was always a big fan of Letterman and him,
yeah, us
and
too.
You know, even back as far back as Saturday Night Live. So that was like this was super cool. And then it was Gary Busey, and who's the other one? Sorry,
oh, Penn Jillette.
Gary Busey and Penn Jillette was really fun. He came on. That was a really quick scene. But Gary Busey was the Gary Busey was very, very interesting. probably the most surreal moment. On any of the Sharknado movies, we were rehearsing the scene with it. So it's him, Tara Reid, David Hasselhoff, and then Ryan Newman, who played the daughter. And so we cleared everybody out of the room and we're rehearsing this. And so, you know, the movie's weird and there's stuff like quantum boxes and weird dialogue and stuff. And Gary's like, so I don't understand. Okay, there's sharks and a tornado. And like, so we're trying to explain to him what it is. And then they start rehearsing and he starts asking David Hasselhoff a little bit about like, well, what the quantum box does, I don't understand. And so Ryan and I, there's nobody in the room, but Ryan and I, and and the other three, and Ryan and I kind of just step back and just watch this conversation happen between Gary and David Hasselhoff, and David Hasselhoff trying to explain to Gary Busey what's going on. And then Tara Reid kind of being the mediator between the two of trying to kind of get it back around to like, let's focus this. And Ryan and I were just trying not to laugh because it was insane, because you're starting to listen to the logic that they're trying to put into this. And it's like, well, it's Sharknado.
Of course.
We have sharks and tornado, and you're trying to put logic
to
it.
And the
but
idea
it was one of those
that
moments.
It's Gary Busey putting logic into it.
I just don't understand. What's a quantum box? And it's like, just say the line, please. How we basically dealt with it, because he was just getting bogged down into it. I turned to Gary. I said, because we were running, you know, we have 12 hours to shoot these movies, and we have no time to do these scenes. And, you know, this was probably like the sixth or seventh scene, a different location in that place we were shooting, and we had to get going. And so I turned to Gary and I go, Gary, I got an idea. I'm going to turn the camera on you, and I'm just going to let you improv for the next 10 minutes. And he's going, that's a great idea. And so we did two 10-minute takes of him just like going off the rails, kind of sort of hitting the beats and stuff. And it was brilliant in how insane it was. And then we basically got him out of the room. We did a reverse, and I did the close-ups on the other actors, and we kind of picked it up and picked the pieces up. And in the movie, it makes sense that it works. It is funny. And we did, I think it's on the deleted scenes, we put like the full version of his rant into the,
oh,
into
I've
the deleted
see that.
Scenes on the... It's insane. It was but that was the way we did it, and it worked.
I'm looking at some of these guest stars, and I mean it's kind of like how we put this podcast together. These are our people of choice: Charo, Bo Derek, Wayne Newton, Susan Anton, Lou Ferrigno.
Well, no, in Sharknado 5, Charo plays the Queen of England because of course it's Sharknado, and Fabio plays the Pope. So, and he speaks Italian. It's amazing.
Perfect.
Were there any complaints about Fabio being the Pope?
I don't know. It was, you know, the whole Fabio thing happened. We were in Italy, and I literally, it was the day before we were about to shoot, and I'm like, why don't we have the Pope in this movie? So I called the producers going, we need a Pope. We need to film the Pope because it doesn't make any sense with this other thing. The Pope needs to be there, meets Finn, and gives him something important. And they're going, well, I don't know if we buy that. It's like, well, okay, what do we need to do? And so we went back and forth for 20 minutes and going, okay, that works. And so they had to find a Pope costume that night. They found a Pope costume. We didn't have Fabio at the time. We didn't know who was going to play it. So we had a small crew. So I ended up playing the Pope for these scenes. So I'm basically Fabio's double in a weird, bizarre world where Fabio doubles other people. I'm doubling Wonderful. Fabio because we didn't know it was going to be him. So we left it so the reverses would be shot in L.A., and then they call and say Fabio's going to be the Pope. And so that's how the Pope thing happened. So, yes, you know, and in addition to the fact that Tara and Ian had to kiss my hand as the Pope, so I think that was kind of fun.
How did you approach Olivia Newton-John? You don't see her Olivia, doing much these days.
I don't think she's done a movie, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, I think in like probably 15
Gotta
years,
be.
Maybe
Gotta
a little
be.
Longer. And she was on our list as far back as 3, and one of our line producers, Dylan Vox and Scotty Mullen, our casting director and the writer on this one, have been courting her for a very long time, and it worked out for this movie. And it was so – that was another one of those things that was just really cool to have her on set. She was there with her daughter, Chloe. Mm-hmm. They play these kind of kooky scientists that kind of help Tara Reid a little bit, her character in the movie. And Olivia was up for anything. I mean, she's just so good.
Nice to hear.
And she has such great timing. We actually they're the sequence with Tara. We wrote a song in honor of Olivia Newton-John called "Brand New You" that was kind of has that sort of Xanadu early '80s vibe. So, you know, we just loved her presence, and she actually gave Scotty and I these shark tooth necklaces. It was a really nice gift. So it's like that meant a lot to me as well. It was really, really sweet.
Would you like to use this moment to point out that Olivia Newton-John was a Jew?
Yes,
is a Jew?
You. I was, Frank knows exactly how
I'm reading
think.
Your thoughts. We've done
While
so many of these.
While you were talking about Olivia Newton-John, I was saying, I got to jump in and say that Olivia Newton-John is a Jew.
There you go.
And she had these, like, I think her parents, well, like her father and uncle were these, like, big intellectual
I
Jews.
Think her uncle was a famous scientist.
Yeah.
Niels Bohr or something.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I have to look that up.
Well,
I'll
that makes sense that she's a scientist.
And Olivia Newton-John always looked like such a goyim, but Jew.
This is something I wanted to ask you, Anthony. Maybe the answer is obvious. Once you guys set on the title of Sharknado, you knew you were in love with that title. How did you get – was it a long journey to this idea that during storms sharks could get swept up? And they said, okay, these two things work together.
It was you know, a lot of stuff, it's just like, you know, you combine two things. And then, you know, they were developing the script, and it just was a natural progression of what it
right.
was. It was always
– You didn't
like,
think of that
you
before you thought of Sharknado, tornado. Though. You locked in on the title, and then it was a bit of serendipity.
Well, no, we knew what it was. The two images I think that we locked on is that there's sharks in a tornado, and a chainsaw needs to be involved. I think Jake did an early drawing with a guy in one of those diving bell thing holding a chainsaw. Even before Ian even was involved or anything. I mean, that was just some silly concept art that he created before any of this happened. There was this thing that we knew there was something special, and we were talking about it even before it was greenlit. Of like, oh, you know, it'd be cool if this and that, and then this all happened. So yeah, there was just a lot of it was kind of funny too that the script and the Thunder Road ended up having a chainsaw in it because we were thinking along the same lines.
Didn't you hear from somebody who said that this had happened? that sharks were sucked up in a storm and landed in somebody's backyard.
I think in Perth or something. Okay, so you want to know the scary part of Sharknado? We are the crystal ball for what will happen, because every time you go, this is ridiculous, this stuff doesn't happen, things happen. And one of the big ones that I remember is we've shot in Orlando, the third movie, and 2 months after we left, I don't know how this is possible. A diesel truck full of sharks overturned on the freeway.
Wow.
We left Australia, and then suddenly sharks were raining down in some place. Like earlier this year, there was like sharks dropping down in some places. So, and then the scariest one of all. So in number three, Oh Hell No. We originally approached Donald Trump to play the president of the United States, which was ultimately going to be played by Mark Cuban. So, you know, we were this close to having the president of the United States be Donald Trump in Sharknado, and we basically ended up with him as our Sharknado president in reality.
Wow.
So it's kind of interesting. So
how bizarre.
Yeah, and it was a timing thing. It literally was, they didn't get back to us in time, and we had to start shooting, and suddenly they cast somebody else, and it was too late. But they were interested in doing it. So, I mean, I think more people would have voted for him if he was running through the White House with a machine gun kicking down sharks. He would have won the popular vote at that point, because it's like, hell, come on. I want that guy around the country.
So tell us again what's the full title? Sharknado 5?
Sharknado 5, Global Swarming, and it airs August 6th, which is this coming Sunday on Sci-Fi. Check your local listings, because it airs in weird time things, but I think it's 8 or 9 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, and then adjust.
And tell us the tagline.
The tagline is "Make America Bait Again."
I love it.
Now,
yeah, we have a blast with this.
We could interview you for hours, Anthony, just about the cast.
And I know.
Bless
crazy.
Your heart for putting these people. I mean, George R. R. Martin, Robert Klein. I mentioned Lou Ferrigno. Susan Anton. When was the last time you heard that name?
Oh, my God.
Yeah. Gosh. Golden
you know,
Girl.
You know, George R. R. Martin.
George R. R.
Was
Martin,
was
yeah.
Was so top secret, like, we got a call saying he wanted to be in it, and we had to go to New Mexico, and he owned a movie theater there. And we filmed it there, and we were like under lock and key. No one knew he was in the movie until they watched the film. And then everybody on the internet was so pissed. It's like, he's in Sharknado and he's not writing the next Game of Thrones book. What the hell? So everybody was all mad at us because we took him away from writing the book.
And
they were like, oh, this is cool. No, they were mad at that.
And I just got the melody in my head now. From Ronnie and Tyshir.
Uh-oh.
It was ding, 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 ding.
This is from Midnight Cowboy?
Ding. Da 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 da.
All right, Anthony, that's your assignment, is find out for us how you are connected and related.
I will do that.
So,
I will look
we need
into that.
To know.
So it's the director. We've been talking. This has been Gilbert and Frank's Amazing Colossal Obsessions. And we've been talking to the director of Sharknado 5. And what is that title again?
Global Swarming.
Global Swarming.
Global Swarming. Anthony C. Ferrante, who may or may not be related to Ferrani and Teicher.
And give our best to Robbie, who was Murray Slaughter's son on the Ted Baxter's adopted son on the Mary Tyler Moore Show.
Yeah,
Robbie Rist.
Yeah. You got to get him into. You got to bring him on another show. He's fantastic.
Yeah, I hear he's a great storyteller.
He's an amazing storyteller, and the thing is that he has actually been been a part of something pop culture every decade. Like, you know, he was part of Brady Bunch, and then he was part of Galactica 80, and then he was part of Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, then Doc McStuffins and Sharknado. So where pop culture phenomena goes, Robbie goes. But he's also an amazing musician.
Yeah,
he plays in 50 million bands in Los Angeles.
That's what we hear.
He's Prince and Elvis Costello rolled into one. I mean, he's just an amazing guy.
Robbie Rist, write it down. And bless your heart for the Warren Zevon reference. My old neighbor in the Kings Road Apartments in Los Angeles.
You're the third person that actually got the reference. And one of my dream movies is I would really love to make the Warren Zevon biopic because I love his story and the journey and that documentary on when he was going to pass away.
Yeah.
Like he did that, you know, the last album he did, he knew he was dying of cancer.
The Wind.
And so they followed him around. The Wind, great album. And you saw how, like, well, you know what? If I'm going to go out, I'm going to go out on my own terms. And that song, Keep Me in Your Heart,
yes.
One of the greatest lines in the history of songwriting is, my wheels keep turning, but I'm running out of steam. And that was the last song he recorded in his living room. And you can't not listen to that album and go, how often is an album written and performed by someone that knows that they're dying? It has this same sense of humor.
Yep, yep.
And you know all the artists that came to support him. I mean, anybody that doesn't know much about Zevon, they should go find that documentary, but also buy that album and listen to the lyrics. It's cathartic.
Yes,
and it's beautiful. Such an amazing tunesmith.
It's a VH1 documentary, as I recall.
Yeah.
It was a making of. I was living in his building at the time, so I actually got to see some of those people come and go. That was shot in the Kings Road Apartments in West Hollywood, where he recorded. He was at one point too ill to travel, and that's where they recorded a lot of that record. And I got to see those people coming and going, and them shooting some of it. Well, but he was a great artist for so many reasons.
The Letterman interview, you know, another quote that he said is like, "What have you learned about that?" You know, he's interviewing him, knowing this is the last time he's going to see him. He devoted a whole episode to him, and he used to fill in for Paul Schaefer. Warren Zevon did on the show. And he goes, you know, what have you learned about all this? And he goes, you know, I learned to enjoy every sandwich. And it's like it's a good mantra for people to take to heart. You know, enjoy everything. And I think that's, you know, I mean, you know, I make movies because I enjoy it. And you know, we just go and do the best that we can and have fun. And I think that, you know, there was a lot of life in that man. And
yes, indeed.
You know, he's left a lot. I was just listening to his Best Of album a couple weeks ago, and just Played All Night Long.
Yep, that's from The Envoy.
He somehow rhymed. Brucellosis.
Yep,
he's the only guy that could use the word brucellosis, brilliantly use it in a song. All the cows have brucellosis. We'll get by
right.
somehow.
Oh, wrong album. That's from Bad Luck Streak and Dancing School. I misspoke.
Yeah.
They're all great. And that Letterman interview, that whole hour, you can find it on, I believe you can find it online. It's well worth seeing.
Yeah, and then buy any album of that.
He
man.
Was a
like
genius.
Said, he just...
So, once again, this has been Gilbert and Frank's Amazing Colossal Obsessions, and we've been talking to Anthony C. Ferrante, who may or may not be related to Ferrante and Teicher. And what's the new movie, and when's it airing again?
Well, wait, before we do it, you should say it's a podcast NATO as you do in
podcast
the film. Safari.
It's a podcast NATO!
Anthony, thank you. This was funny. Congratulations.
Thank you. August 6th, Sci-Fi. Thank you guys so much
for
having
me. We'll
send
our people
really
there.
Appreciate it.
Take care, buddy.
Thanks, Gilbert. Thanks, Frank.
Colossal Obsessions.